afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. The second and third segment today, I am very pleased to have a conversation with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. We previously recorded Wednesday evening. So as you know, he's here every other week, and I do so enjoy our conversations that we have. So I hope you do too. And of course, today is Friday, November 2nd, 2018, the first 20 minutes of this program, I am live. And so at least I pinched myself and yes, ouch, I am live. So anyway, we got a lot to talk about for the first 20 minutes, and it certainly was a hectic day in the markets. Jobs report came out, the market was up a couple hundred points, it came down a couple hundred points, and, you know, gold was trying to break out, but gold really didn't do bad, still struggling in the New York spot price aftermarket at $1,233, you know, down less than a buck. Silver, we had a high, it almost touched $15 today, $14.99, and it settled back to $14.82. Platinum was up $11 at $874, and palladium continues to rise. That was up a little over 2%, $1,120, up $23. The USDX today was up 0.17 at 96.47, and again, we're seeing that breakaway from gold, from, you know, the dollar up and gold down. So yeah, it's down a little less than a buck, but it's still held in there very good. I mean, 10-year treasuries, wait till you hear the number on that, popped big today. Crude oil was down 0.70 at 62.99. We're going to talk a little bit about the Iran sanctions. That's kicking in here Sunday evening. So we're going to start the week. Next week, it's going to be really interesting. And the Dow did manage to come back somewhat after a couple hundred points, but we're still looking down 110 at 25,270. The NASDAQ was down 77 points. Little over 1% at 7,356, and the S&P was down 17 at 2,723. Now hold on to your seats. The 10-year yield, 3.21%. That was up 0.07 points today. So a huge day in the 10-year yield. And Japan was up a little over 2%. Hong Kong was up over 4% overnight. Over 1,000 points, 4.21, almost 4.25% in Hong Kong. And pretty much everything is quiet. But let's go ahead and talk about the, and again, you know, there was hope earlier today that the tensions with this trade spat with China might become a little bit better. But then again, because we had President Trump come out and make statements, but then Larry Kudlow came out and said, well, you know, maybe, you know, things aren't as good with China as what we would hope them to be. So a little bit of a conflict with President Trump. Kudlow said he's not as optimistic as he once was on the prospects for a China trade deal. It was just yesterday or the day before that he came out all positive. So again, ladies and gentlemen, their statements are powerful. They move markets. And, you know, Larry Kudlow is a strong dollar. He hates gold. And again, as you remember, when he was hired by President Trump to be his economic advisor, the big statement was, go long the dollar, buy king dollar, and sell gold. So Kudlow, he is not our friend when it comes to those of us who believe that gold is real money. And and again, we saw the 10-year treasury yield rise the most in a month. And we saw the dollar gain a little bit. Let's see if there's any other interesting news. Let's get to the jobs report anyway. The U.S. labor market continues to fire on all cylinders, of course. In October, the U.S. economy created 250,000 jobs, topping expectations. The unemployment rate held at 3.7%, matching the lowest level since 1969. Certainly not the longest, though, or the lowest level in history of this country, but 1969 is a pretty... But does it really feel that things are humming and feeling good? Maybe because all of these outside tensions is actually taking away from the positive of this stronger economy. But you know what? There's always something else for you to look at and to consider, and we're going to talk about that right after the jobs report. Of course, that number was higher than what the economists had expected, and wage growth in October rose 0.2% over last month and 3.1% over last year, and this is the fastest pace of annual wage gains since April of 2009. The BLS said in a release that the Hurricane Michael, which had made landfall during the report's reference week, had no discernible effect on the national employment or unemployment estimates for October. Okay, yeah, we believe you. And let's see if there's any other interesting notes in here. We did see shares of Apple. They were down as much as 6%. Today, their earnings disappointed investors. Let's see if there's anything else that's interested in this job report. Construction. All the major industries that's tracked by the BLS had added jobs. Construction and manufacturing employment both rising by more than 30% in October. Education and health services saw the largest overall employment increase, with this industry adding 46,700 jobs last month. This I thought was interesting. Job gains in September, they were revised down to 118,000 from 134. So we'll have to see again. I always love these revisions, you know. But there was another report by the Challenger Gray and Christian, and they show that job cuts rocket 37% in October. And the research firm reported employee job cuts rose again 37% in October. This figure is the highest since July of 2015. And the Challenger Gray and Christian data is often used as a hint about what the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, releases for its unemployment rate when it posts its state employment unemployment summary. Although these two pieces of research use different methodologies, the size of the cuts nevertheless is a sign that part of the economy may be rapidly slowing. Now we're going to break it out in some of these areas. You have the most significant part of the report is that 58.2% of cuts were from Verizon Communications. And of course, these were part of voluntary severance deals offered to 40,000 workers. The layoffs are part of a trend which has begun at several large companies as they approach the end of the year. We have General Motors. They're going to offer buyouts to 38,000 workers. Rumors that were partially confirmed by the company are that Ford Motor Company may restructure, and over 70,000 jobs are being evaluated for future downsizing. Tariffs, hits on earnings, have been given as a major reason for concerns about jobs at both large and small firms. Well, at least they have a reason other than the economy is not as good as, and people aren't doing as well as what everybody believes that we're doing. So the Challenger data is very different from results from, of course, ADP. We talked about ADP on Wednesday. Its numbers are closely followed ahead of those from the BLS. And Challenger Gray named another large company which made large layoffs in September, which its researchers claimed is part of a larger trend. And of course, I think you probably can guess which one. It was Wells Fargo and Company. They cut 26,000 jobs. Your financial firms are under pressure as we see these interest rates rise. And of course, that was in October. When we talk about $2 trillion being lost in the markets in October, I can't imagine that next month's, you know, these numbers, are only going to continue to increase. Wells Fargo, we all know, has been plagued by scandal. Challenger also said that the retail sector continues to be in trouble. We talk about that here all the time. Retail layoffs were 7,350 in October, which brings the annual total for this sector this year to 92,375. We talked earlier this week about the several big box retailers that are in a battle with one another for market share. Let's go on and see what else is interesting about this report. Andrew Challenger, he's the vice president of Challenger, Gray, and Christmas, said the Verizon, Wells Fargo cuts, along with the bankruptcy of Toys R Us, are part of an ongoing trend. All three of these companies are in industries facing serious disruptions, requiring companies to pivot to meet consumer demand. Buyout offers are significant. And it goes on and he talks about that they are also in position to help facilitate the change process and take care of their workers. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, retirement accounts. So, you know, they get to do these severance, accounts and, you know, it helps their, you know, this is their way of dealing with, you know, hey, they can't afford to pay these retirement accounts. So we'll have to see if the job addition can stay ahead of layoffs. And, you know, we'll continue to report on this. But anyway, let's go on. U.S. imports hit an all-time high. Trade deficit with China sets a new record. Okay, the nation's trade deficit rose 1.3% in September to a seven-month high. A seven-month high as imports set a fresh record and a confounding efforts by the administration to bring deficits down. The deficit edged up to $54 billion from a revised $53.3 billion in August. This is the Commerce Department said on Friday. This is the second biggest monthly trade deficit since President Trump got in office in January 2017. But the trade deficit with China set a new record despite the U.S. tariffs meant to punish the country for what the U.S. considers unfair trade practices. The U.S. trade deficit added up to almost $447 billion in the first 9 months of 2018. That is compared to about $404 billion in the same span in 2017. So the U.S. is on track to post its biggest deficit in a decade. You know, and everybody can say, well, you know, the economy is doing better. You know, wages are rising. People have more money. But cheap people want something that's cheaper. And as long as these products are coming in, they're going to go for the cheaper. And this is why you see this deficit widen. It's not rocket science, you know. You had imports rose 1.5% to a record $266 billion. The U.S. imported more telecommunications gear. The U.S. imported more computers, clothes, toys, among other things. You can say that maybe some of the influx of imported goods have been brought into the U.S. ahead of the holiday season. Maybe, you know, retailers are bringing in, you know, maybe they purchase more knowing that these tariffs are going to make the prices go higher. So, you know, maybe they're increasing their inventories that, you know, perhaps widen this gap. We won't know until probably after the holiday season. So we did see exports did increase from about 1.5%. And of course, what the U.S. Exported more of, oil, aircraft, autos, and interesting, drugs. So the impact of U.S. tariffs on foreign steel and billions of dollars in Chinese goods has had a limited impact so far. One thing that I think is interesting that I wanted to talk about, we got a few minutes left of this first segment before we go into break, and James Corbett will be joining us, is on Sunday evening, midnight, is going to mark a dividing line in the world of oil. Beyond that point, anyone unloading a tanker from Iran risks the full wrath of the U.S. government. The Middle East's third biggest oil producer has already seen many buyers flee, with sales tumbling 37% since President Donald Trump has announced that he'd reimpose sanctions. Once those restrictions formally kick in on November 5th, the overall supply disruption could become the biggest since Libya erupted in civil war at the start of the decade. So there are signs. Now, the impact will be mitigated as some buyers win partial exemptions, while other producers, particularly Saudi Arabia, pump more to fill the gap. Still, there are doubts about their capacity to do so, and the global nature of the oil market means nobody is fully insulated, even U.S. drivers. And we haven't even seen a drop of Iranian crude for decades. We can and we might, and we have felt with gasoline prices hovering around $3, are feeling the pain at the pump. We saw oil futures, they climbed to a four-year high last month on the growing concerns that there could be a shortage as sanctions bite a little bit deeper. And you want to know, what are these countries going to do? I mean, some of them are already doing something, but it takes a long time to get things done when you have a country that's telling them who they can buy from. So, you know, the U.S. has agreed to let 8 countries avoid. They can continue to purchase Iranian oil. It's Japan, India, South Korea is a couple of them, but it's only temporary. And it's a large part of the impact has not yet happened. There's price-wise, you know, we could still see some upward pressure to come, possibly a big wave of upward pressure. But I think things are going to tighten up. Yeah, I don't think we have seen anything, any results from these sanctions going into effect. Is it going to bring them to the table? I don't know. Are they going to do something? I don't know. The goal of the administration is to choke off revenue to Iran's economy. As I mentioned before, there are some waivers that are being granted in exchange for continued imports, but I guess today Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is supposed to announce the number of exemptions later today. So interesting to follow. We'll follow up on that on Monday. I'm heading into a break. 1-800-375-4188. You better get your gold and silver now, because I don't think we're going to have any ease up on these rising prices in the precious metals. I'll be returning with James Corbett. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Gentlemen, you're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. And as always, I'm so pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And as you remember, James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report. He started in 2007, and in 2012, James became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster. I was created by Bob Chapman, and I do encourage you to visit both websites. James's website is thecorbettreport.com, and of course, visit the website of the internationalforecaster.com. And make sure you request a complimentary copy of the newsletter. And, well, hello, James.
Well, hello, Melody. Thanks for having me on.
Welcome back. You know, sometimes I don't even know where to begin sometimes because everything is just so bizarre out there. But we do have elections next week. We have the U.S. midterm elections. The American voters, they got a lot on their minds as they go to the polls, and they're going to decide who's going to lead the two houses of Congress during the second half of President Trump's first term as president. Are you hearing anything in your neck of the woods? And, you know, how important do you think these midterms are to things like, you know, economic growth, you know, just wars and, you know, things in general?
I'm not hearing a lot about the midterm elections here in Japan, and that's a dual function of one, I think there isn't a lot of coverage of it here in Japan, but secondly, I'm also neck deep in my next documentary, so I have not been following the day-to-day news very much lately, so that might be a part of this, but I think it really isn't that much of a concern internationally as it is domestically, so perhaps we wouldn't expect so much. And my own personal take as an anarchist, as someone who does not believe in voting at all, if it actually changed anything, they would outlaw it. I don't think it's going to fundamentally have a change on the big issues. I mean, of course, there are always the political football issues that they dangle before the public that you'll see at least a change in rhetoric or a change in tone from administration to administration, but the big issues remain the same. And exactly like with Trump, talking the talk when it came to, for example, Syria, and what's the latest? Oh, yeah, they're going to stay in Syria indefinitely. Or talking the talk when it came to, oh, the Fed is blowing a big, fat, ugly bubble with their low interest rates, and now that they're hiking interest rates and Trump is the president, it's like, oh, they're crazy. Why are they hiking interest rates? They're trying to pop the bubble. So, I mean, again, it's all rhetoric. It's all circus. It's all sideshow. It doesn't matter to the big scheme of things. And since the documentary that I'm working on is regarding World War One and the upcoming 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War One. My mind is on the big, big issues, and of course the specter of a third world war, which you know, none of us wants to see, but I hope we would not sleepwalk into it the way a lot of the population sleepwalked into World War One.
Any details you'd like to share? Any nibbles of information you might have regarding your documentary?
So my documentary is not so much about the war itself. It's about the what led to World War One, because that's where I find the parallels. And I talked about this in my presentation in Denmark last year, where I talked about the parallels between the build-up to World War One and what we're seeing right now, which is eerie and haunting enough. Specifically talking about the rising German Empire back at the turn of the 20th century that was starting to compete with the British Empire. And obviously the British Empire didn't really take kindly to that, and a cabal of characters that I will introduce in the documentary did something about it. They formed a secret society that they even openly talked about, so a bit of a contradiction there, but their secret society was dedicated to the extension of the British Empire and defeating, of course, the British Empire's biggest problem at that time, which was Germany. And so we see World War One didn't start with the assassination of the Archduke in 1914. It really started much, much before that point, with the entire coordination of the diplomatic and political and propagandistic machinery of the British Empire being directed towards war with Germany. And it was inevitable from that point forward, or I don't want to say inevitable because that perhaps puts the wrong emphasis on it, but they were certainly planning for it, preparing it, plotting it, and making sure it happened. And it just so happened that there was that assassination that set it off, but that wasn't really what set off World War One. In the same way, of course, in our current context, we're seeing the rise of the Chinese Empire to combat the American Empire, or to rival the American Empire, or whatever you want to call it. There are a lot of parallels to the situation. And sadly, it very well could be the case, and there are lots of reasons to believe, that the same type of elite inner cabal that engineered World War One are looking to engineer a Third World War. And the bigger picture of this is that I don't think that ultimately this is about China versus the U.S. This is about the elite, in quotation marks, I don't use that word unironically, but the elite, the would-be elite, versus everyone else. And, I'm not convinced that America is meant to win this next big conflict, and the American people might be thrown out under the bus by their misleaders who they believe represent them.
You know, I was reading an article prior to, and there's a couple of questions I wanted to ask. You know, how does the internet, you know, because back then information wasn't shared and you didn't have people have access, you know, if they care to research a little bit more than just, you know, popping up, you know, somebody's opinion and so forth. How does the internet play into, is it maybe the length of time that this has taken, or does the internet play anything to perhaps deter this from happening, to keep them from following through at all with the access? But I'm told, too, that the United States, I have customers in China. They live in Hawaii. They go to China. And they said to get information in China, it takes weeks. We don't think of that.
No, that's exactly right. It's an interesting question because there are multiple levels to this, and I think there are aspects from which the internet makes it more difficult to censor certain information or to make sure that the spin is always applied in the way that the same cabal of characters would want it to be applied. At the same time, it also enables information warfare on a level that we've never seen before. So I think the sword cuts both ways. And I say that because, of course, at the very least, even the most skeptical out there have to understand that, of course, the propagandists of our current day and age, and of course, I mean, they'd like you to believe, oh, propaganda, that was all, you know, 100 years ago. They did that in World War One. They did that in World War Two. But there's no propagandists today. We all know better than that. The propagandists of our current day and age are looking at the way that information travels on the internet and trying to weaponize that for their own aims. They've talked about that openly in documents. For example, in 2003, the Pentagon had an information operations roadmap where they talked about fighting the net as if it were an enemy weapon system. We've seen documents released as part of the Snowden releases that talked about the ways that British GCHQ, the British equivalent of NSA, was talking about magic operations, as they called them. Basically, how do you infiltrate a group online, and how do you change their narrative, and how do you confuse them with information and things like this. They likened it to being a magician and making people look one way when they should be looking the other, and this sort of thing. So we know this goes on, and they're looking at this. They're looking at the meme wars and these NPC memes and whatever else. And at the very least, even if these are not themselves weaponized memes, which they very well could be, the propagandists of our current age are looking at this and seeing how to create these memes and how to get them trending in the population to get people thinking in certain ways. So in some ways, perhaps we were even more susceptible to information operations than we were 100 years ago when people were still reading newspapers and maybe, if they were lucky, had a radio to receive information. Now we have 24/7 streams of information coming into our ears, and you better believe it helps to shape people's understanding of the world, not necessarily for the better.
We're going to talk about memes in a little bit, but while we're still in World War One, you know, I was reading an article prior to the program, and it was about the amount of the $717 billion that which is the U.S. military budget, and I just couple of lines caught my attention, and it says the American people and the world enjoy the technologies that are produced by the armed forces. You have the internet, Google, GPS technology. There's a whole list of technology that was produced in part or in whole by the U.S. military through DARPA. And so it goes on, it talks about this, still raises a question, what does this have to do with today's military? And when we're thinking about fighting wars, you have, and they talk about it's these corporations, these tech companies are basically assisting the military and not the other way around. And, you know, it's kind of so you'd think that the U.S. would take the leading role, and you said we wouldn't necessarily win, but yet it seems like, you know, everywhere we've been, you know, the destruction from the armed forces, you know, you can, you know, Korea, Vietnam, Cambodia, Syria, Yemen. And the article goes on and says that the people of Yemen aren't confused. They see American labels from bomb debris dropped by the Saudi Air Force. They know who are responsible. And
you raise a number of important issues there, one of which is one of these things that the military and defenders of the military like to throw out there as justification for the bloodshed that's spilled all over the world through all periods of history. Well, I mean, you've got to have a military because they help, you know, create the internet and all these things that you love. You wouldn't have it without the military. I mean, first of all, that's disgusting. The utilitarian thrust of it is disgusting. Without the shedding of millions of lives in World War One, for example, you know, you wouldn't have had development of the tank, which led to et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's truly a disgusting mindset to be in. But even so, it's false because it's the old problem, the fallacious argument that was identified in the 19th century by Bastiat. It's the seen and the unseen. We do not know the ways that we could have invested our money, our time, our energies as a society if we weren't investing it in warfare and developing bombs. And who's to say that we wouldn't actually be much more technologically advanced if we didn't go around dropping bombs on civilizations for, you know, most of our most of history? Wouldn't we be actually further advanced? And there is an argument to be made there. Also, secondarily, as you say, actually, it's mostly the corporations helping out the military more so than the military helping out the corporations. There are many examples of that. And of course, you know, now it's coming out the NSA has a very large tender out for various firms to provide cloud services for them. And part of the whole Snowden scandal was the fact that the NSA were using these contractors. So it wasn't, you know, militarily approved sworn officers of the United States that were handling this information. It was Joe Blow, high school dropout, you know, at this subcontractor for the NSA had all of this access to this surveillance data. Again, so much of the military has been privatized that, no, it's the corporations running the deal, not the military. So there's a lot of problems with that kind of argument. The other side of this is that ultimately, here's another aspect of the way this plays into a potential for a World War III scenario when we're talking about the internet and these technologies. Now that society is so thoroughly dependent on these technologies and so many jobs and livelihoods now depend on these things that didn't exist a few decades ago, including my own. I mean, I'm sitting here as a podcaster in Japan. We're so dependent on this that obviously To the extent that they won't be able to control information on the internet, they will try to shut it down. And that can be accomplished because, as we've seen in recent years, oops, this ship accidentally, quote unquote, dragged an anchor across this major wire. And now suddenly Egypt is off the internet. You know, these types of things happen. And do you not think that that is not part of the modern day war strategies? Of course, that will be the first thing to go whenever a serious, true hot war breaks out.
And, you know, we talk about distractions. You know, when I asked you about the elections, how, you know, perhaps they're seen in, it's like no one's paying any attention to our elections, but yet here the news feed is 24/7. Mm-hmm. People are all up in arms, you know, saying things and doing things. And to me, it's just like all distractions. No one is really seeing what's going on behind all of these distractions. And, like so many, and, you know, going back to, you know, elections, German Chancellor Merkel announced the other day that she won't be seeking another term, which ends in 2021. Too bad it's not today, but, you know, she has till 2021. How is her departure from her office will affect that area?
Well, it will affect a lot of things in Europe because, of course, Germany is really the heart of the European Union enterprise at this point, with the Brexit at least kind of sort of in the offing, maybe, you know, question mark. But at any rate, Germany is clearly the driver of the European Union at this point, along with France. And so to have Merkel out of there, it does put a question mark over what's going to happen next in that front. And another aspect to this, which I found interesting, now that there's been the change in power in Brazil and Merkel heading out the door, it looks like some of the backbone of the Paris Climate Agreement of 2015 is starting to show some cracks and potentially might falter. And I think that's a good thing for humanity, ultimately, because the idea, again, as we've talked about, the idea that there's a global thermostat, and if you get the right level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you're going to have some perfect Valhalla temperature that will be perfect. And too much of carbon dioxide and we'll all die. That hoax that is being perpetrated as a type of economic attack on humanity. And it is ultimately about trying to stifle economic progress and innovation and the lifting out of poverty of ultimately billions of people. We've seen more people lifted out of poverty in the past half century than in all of human history, and more could be lifted out of poverty unless they start to try to squelch economic growth. And that's exactly what this carbon dioxide agenda is about. So with Merkel out, and you know, it depends who comes in to replace it, but if it's not part of the status quo, there we could see some major changes going forward.
You know, you did mention Brazil. They elected he was a former army captain and once a fringe political party as their new president, Bolsonaro, I guess I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But he did express disdain for women, minorities, the rule of law. True, false? If you've heard.
Good question. Yeah, no, I haven't followed that at all, and I haven't looked into it, so I'm not knowledgeable on it, but it does seem, at any rate, that this is part of a broader narrative that's happening globally right now.
Yes.
So, interesting to see.
All righty, we're going to talk about memes when we get back. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my special guest, James Corbett.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. And heading into the break, I said that we were going to talk about your newsletter from last week. You wrote about how switching letters in a meme can bring into focus an otherwise obscure acronym. You referenced the 2001 A Space Odyssey, evil supercomputer HAL, a thinly veiled reference to IBM. And if you change each letter in HAL to the next one in the alphabet to get the subtle reference, and you also use that the word MOB to get NPC.
What on earth does that mean?
Going on NPC? I did follow some of that. It's like, say what?
Yeah, it's pretty confusing, isn't it? So this is a concept I came across. It was really just a few weeks ago, and I don't even know how I discovered it, but it seemed very underground at the time that I discovered it, and then a week later it was on the tip of everybody's tongue. So this is the way information rolls out in the internet age, I guess. But this is a meme, which for people who are not au courant with the internet parlance means it's an image, an image that's manipulatable or it has text or captions that you can swap out to try to represent an idea. And essentially, this is an idea that comes from video games. Actually, I'm being told by people that apparently it originated in Dungeons and Dragons or something. But anyway, it's the idea of non-playable characters, NPCs. So, for example, when you're playing a video game and you go to one of the computer-generated characters and maybe they'll talk to you in the game and give you some piece of information or something, but they'll only do what they've been programmed to do and no more. And if you try to do something beyond that, they'll just give you whatever pre-programmed, regurgitated response they've been programmed to give by the computer. Well, the idea is, you know, isn't it funny when you're talking to your political opponents and they keep regurgitating these same things and saying the same things that the people on TV are saying or have told them to say? It's like they're non-playable characters. They are NPCs. So this caught on recently, and especially among the MAGA crowd. And so basically, instead of SJW, which I'm sure many people have become familiar with in recent years, now it's becoming NPC. These liberals who are just saying whatever they heard on MSNBC last night are a bunch of non-playable characters. They've been programmed to think certain things by the TV, and that's now all they can say and think. And the interesting thing about this meme, this idea that took off, was just how vehemently and viciously it was responded to. It really touched a button, and you started getting people on the left were complaining that these literally worse than Hitler Nazi Trumpists are now dehumanizing their opponents by calling them NPCs. Do you not see the kind of hypocrisy going on there? You literally Hitler Nazis! How dare you dehumanize us? But that's actually the funny thing about this meme, and what I go on to write about in my newsletter, is it really is the Hall of Mirrors, because the people who are all coming together at this point just to say, hey, you guys are all a bunch of NPCs, well, aren't they all kind of an online mob that's all acting in the same way? I mean, it just seems to be NPC versus NPC. Left versus right. I mean, choose your flavor of NPC. And they're all being programmed, so it seems, by whatever website they go to or whatever television channels they're tuning into. It does seem to explain something, but in a way, it's perhaps everybody is a non-playable character in some form or other, because whatever your expertise and specialty is and the things you like to think about and have informed opinions on, there are many, many more things that you don't know anything about, don't care, it's not your interest, you don't really know. If you hear something, you might repeat it because you don't know. Everyone's like that in some aspects of their lives. So I just wanted to bring a bit of philosophical reflection to the newsletter and maybe put the damper on this drive to create these new labels and categories to fit political opponents in, because ultimately it really is whatever kind of box you're trying to put someone else in is in a way defining you at the same time. And I hope people can see that and see maybe it would be more productive to have conversations with people and treat them as if they are human beings. And that goes on both sides, both ways.
Yes.
And it's difficult to do when we've all been programmed with certain set responses. Oh, you like Trump, you are a Nazi. You dislike Trump, you are an SJW. It's almost like just two computer programs arguing with each other.
You know, even before Trump, even during the Obama, years ago, it was like whenever you tried to have a conversation with someone from a different view, you were right. They just had these set responses. They were all the same. There was no discussion, no thinking. And it was just lately, and I wasn't relating to memes or the NPCs, but I'm thinking, I'm beginning to hear this from, from the other side now. You know, it seems like they're just repeating the things and we're all right. No one's ever wrong. No one's ever, there is no open discussions about anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's,
it's a horrible slippery slope to go down. And as I say, I think perhaps in some way the internet age is actually enabling information operations in a way that has never really been possible before, which is the worrying part of this. I mean, obviously, as someone who operates a website for a living and who would never have had a voice like I do without the internet age, I do obviously think this is overall a good thing to get more people involved and communicating and get their voices out there. But there is the flip side to it, where people are now so glued to their 24/7 news feeds and streams and all this information coming into their heads that they can be programmed. And I don't know how literally to take that analogy, but at any rate, people really do. You are responsible for what you hear, and people are not being very responsible with what they put in their ears these days.
Well, it's not so much, what they hear. It's that they don't even think about it. If somebody says something, it's got to be true. And it goes back to the military. You know, did the military allow us to have the internet as a experiment for control and so forth? But, I guess there's no way to prove that.
That's conspiracy theory, Melanie. You don't want to be a conspiracy theorist.
Oh, of course not. But I also heard that conspiracy theories were usually 90% true. Anyway, I don't know if you wanted to continue on with that. You made something that you use normie to describe those who still get their news. And or would you like to move on to...
Let's move on. I think people can go and read that newsletter because it does get a bit philosophical. But again, I just want to kind of put the damper on this because everything that we've seen in recent years, as I know you know, has been about driving the wedge between people.
Yeah.
And I just want to find some way of putting a damper on that process because it does not lead in directions that I think anyone ultimately wants to go in.
Well, you know, for the last couple of years, Sweden's central bank has been considering issuing a digital currency to adapt to the needs of the increasingly cashless society. Last year, the bank, which is the oldest central bank, issued a report describing what its new e-krona might look like. And last Friday, it called for the design of the electronic currency to move forward so it can be tested. And the pilot would involve the creation of a value-based e-krona that could be stored on a card or a mobile phone app and so forth, and that would allow for traceable transactions. So is Sweden going cashless too quickly? Do you think all these other countries are going to follow?
Yes and yes. For people who don't know, it was, I think, between 2013 and 2017, the amount of cash in circulation in the Swedish economy has dropped by 35%. As they are making a concerted drive that the government has talked about openly of pushing for a cashless society. And now Sweden has the reputation, I don't know if this is measurable precisely, but at any rate, they have the reputation of the most cashless nation. But there is a slightly good news story, I guess, at least good-ish news, from the perspective of people who do think this is a worrying sign, because, well, there are many reasons why I think a cashless society is worrying that we can get into, but at any rate, for people who do think that, there is some sort of ray of sunshine here. This coming from technocracy.news. Central Bank of Sweden makes U-turn on cashless society. Basically, the government, there was a government watchdog that was trying to mandate for state-owned banks that they be required to accept and handle cash. Which makes, I think, makes sense. But basically the competition watchdog said, well, that's not fair to private banks if these rules are only going to apply to state banks. So they're now, apparently they're moving towards making this a just a blanket resolution that all banks will have to handle cash. And you have, of course, some people crying, you know, tears about this. But in the end, again, I think this is pretty basic common sense. Yes, banks should handle cash, shouldn't they? It's one small step in the right direction. But again, I haven't been to Sweden, so I can't say this from personal experience. But from what I understand, cash is really being eliminated everywhere, to the point where you can't take a bus with cash anymore. You have to have some kind of card or chip or whatever. And it's becoming more and more common over there. So I think any step away from that would be good, because, again, and let's get into it if we need to, but the cashless society, of course, is the end of all economic freedom, the ability to transact and interact with people in whatever way you want. It's also the end of privacy, which perhaps is already upon us, but even more so when every single transaction that you make is going to be digitally recorded and stored forever. That's, you know, that's a pretty major step towards the eradication of any type of free citizenry. And for anyone who does care about such things, as I think we all do intuitively, I think there has to be a pretty big propaganda push to say, not only, you know, hey, it's convenient for you to use a card here, why don't you use a card? No, you must use a card for every transaction. Does that not raise the hackles of everyone in the audience?
I think so. I think so. But also, do you think maybe the world has just gotten so big that as individuals we're so small, and it just things don't mean as much as they once did, perhaps, because we're just, we don't seem a part of it anymore.
Yeah. Well, I think we're being at least those lines, aren't we? And you're just a small little part of this bigger thing that's happening, and just go with the flow. It'll always be easier to go with the flow. That's really played out for people, even within our own lifetimes. I remember my father made a huge deal about not getting a cash card, a debit card from his bank. He didn't want one. He wasn't going to do that. No, I'm going to talk to a human being at the teller. I'm going to get cash. And I thought that was just crazy. I mean, what are you talking about? And eventually he did have to relent, because eventually it came to the point where you can't really do all of the things you used to do with the teller at the, you know, in cash. So eventually I think he did get a debit card. But it's interesting now, from my adult perspective, that sticks in my mind. And I think, you know, he has a point, because I am going to be that person with my children when they think, why don't you want the microchip in your hand, Daddy? It'll be so much easier. No, I'm not going to do that.
The United States is preparing new tariffs against all remaining Chinese imports. If the trade talks between the president, Trump, and Xi Jinping fail to reconcile this ongoing trade dispute, I guess it's amounting to $257 billion. That could occur as early as December. During the same time, we've had tariffs rise, 25% aluminum tariffs and 10% in February. During that same time, prices in the UK, Italy, China, Germany, Japan, they're all down almost 5%. So what's really behind these tariffs? How are they shifting military, political, and business alliances around the world? And we have 2 minutes.
Okay, no problem. Let me wrap that up. Well, let's put it this way. The first and obvious ramification of all this is the economic one, a slowdown in global trade that's now being reflected in the manufacturing numbers, manufacturing missing estimates in China and South Korea and Japan and Taiwan in the past month. So I think we're starting to see the beginnings of the slowdown that we all know is going to come as a part of these trade wars. And, of course, the global economic effects of that slowdown is going to have a number of geopolitical effects, and that's hard to pin down. You can't necessarily say because of the global trade slowdown, this person was elected, or this party got into power, or this particular policy was passed. But you know there is some sort of downstream trend there. So this is going to have very large effects, and I guess the only question is how long will this trade spat go on for, and what's the way out of it? Unfortunately, one of the ways out of these types of trade wars is hot wars, as we saw, for example, as we talked about before, the Smoot-Hawley tariffs back in the 30s as part of the build-up towards World War II, and we have other eerie parallels like that. So I'm not saying it necessarily results in war, but it's certainly one of the things that military planners love to keep on the table. And as I say, if it feeds into the larger agenda for the powers that shouldn't be, who want to steer us into a glorious new world order, war is generally the best way to get us there. And whether that's a trade war or a real hot war, I think there are some pretty big changes in the offing here.
Well, you made it. We only have a few seconds left. I want to thank you for joining us once again, James. And I want to encourage the folks to go to the website, thecorbettreport.com. I'm looking forward to the World War I documentary that you're in the midst of making. And ladies and gentlemen, again, thank you for joining us. We'll be back. Until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. Flashing back.